Hey, everybody. This is Nick Deolius. You're listening to the Far Middle Podcast. In this tipsy-turvy world, I hope you're keeping things on an even keel. And maybe, I'm hoping even at the far middle, is becoming part of your weekly routine helps you do that. We're at episode 61 with the far middle, so who are we going to dedicate this one to? Now, maybe the dedication isn't going to go so much to a person, although in the end it is going to be tied to a person. Or maybe the dedication for 61 isn't going to so much as a record, although it's also going to be tied to that. Perhaps the dedication is ultimately going to go to an infamous asterisk. And I speak of what happened in the 1961 baseball season. So another sort of interesting sort of tie to episode 61 is that this happened in 1961 with the baseball season. That was the year when a guy from Hibbing, Minnesota, named Roger Maris, had the nerve to hit 61 home runs in a season to insult baseball fans two ways. First, he broke the revered record that Babe Ruth held, and everybody loved Babe Ruth, where his prior record was 60 home runs in a season. And the second thing he had was he had the nerve or the audacity, Maris did, to not allow New York's favorite player, Mickey Mantle, break the record that season. So there is some irony here. In fact, there's a lot of irony, but one particular point of it, 1961 was the first year baseball expanded its season to 162 games from what was, I believe, 154 games. And the reason they went from 154 to 162 in a season was because they added expansion teams in Washington and in Los Angeles with the Angels. So the schedule sort of dictated that the schedule in terms of games had to expand a bit. And in the start of 1961 calendar year, so this was sometime in January of 61, there was a reporter that was talking to Roger Maris, and the reporter had a question for Maris, which was whether the schedule changes might end up threatening Babe Ruth's single-season home run record. So Maris's answer was really interesting and ironic. He said, "Nobody will touch it. Look up the records, and you'll see that it's a rare year when anybody hits 50 homers, let alone 60. Well, he was going to end up contradicting his own view or answer to that question. Maris and Mantle both made a run at Ruth's 60 home runs that season, and they were neck and neck until Mantle went down with a hip infection, and then it was all Maris from there on out to the end of the season. And that season itself, it really took an emotional and stressful toll on Maris and his health as he marched towards 60 home runs. He started losing his hair in clumps. He smoked like a chimney. He received death threats, and he really, in the end, wasn't considered a real Yankee by New Yorkers like Mantle was. Ford Frick was the Major League commissioner at the time. He was also a personal friend of Babe Ruth's. He said mid-season in 1961 that the record was broken, but if it took more than 154 games to break the record, that's what Ruth did it in, 154 games, the new record was not breaking Ruth's record so much as it was establishing a different record. So when the commish came out with that view, things got rolling, and he sort of indicated because it was going to be a different record, it had to be distinguished in some way as such. And ultimately, another reporter came up with the idea of the asterisk, and that's what we ended up doing for a while after Maris hit his 61st home run in what was the last game of the season in 1961 against the Red Sox. And over time, that little mark, that asterisk, was removed, and Maris became the sole record holder from an official Major League Baseball perspective. And by the way, in 1961, he won his second American League MVP award in a row. He won it in 60 and 61. So Maris is not in the Hall of Fame, although his bat that hit the 61st home run is in the Hall of Fame. He played in 7 World Series between the Yankees and Cardinals, so he had a heck of a career. And episode 61 is dedicated to Roger Maris in his 61 home runs in 1961 to break Babe Ruth's record. It's funny how back then everybody was getting worked up, all the baseball purists, about the number of games and an asterisk next to the record or not having a mark next to that record. And they had no idea the baseball purists did what was coming down the pike. When you start to consider what transpired, unfolded with the Maguires and the Sosas and the Bonds and PEDs and all that stuff. All right, let's take Roger Maris, 61 home runs in the 1961 season, and let's get moving to connecting dots. So if you're confused as to who the single-season home run king is in baseball, it's understandable, right? You got different options and ways to look at it. You got Babe Ruth, who has 60, but he did it in 154 games. You got Roger Maris that has 61, but he needed more games, but he didn't do it with PEDs other than, of course, cigarette nicotine. And then you've got sort of the Maguires and the Sosas and the Barry Bonds to choose from with all the issues surrounding PEDs in those three. Well, you know, this issue of confusion, it goes way beyond things like baseball and home run records, and it looms much larger over mammoth issues that impact all of us. And I'll give you an example of how this is at play with a newspaper and an issue of that newspaper that I came across recently and wanted to share with you. And it was dealing with successive headlines in a single day's sort of issue of this national paper. And it shows, to me at least, how confused and unwilling journalists are to accurately assess what's going on when you're looking in the arenas of geopolitics and energy policy and inflation and the economy. And this paper is not left-leaning or a leftist outlet by any stretch. It's got a business and economic focus. It's got an awesome reputation, and I enjoy, you know, reading this paper on a regular basis. But I'll illustrate to you what I'm talking about. So in this issue, one article to kick things off in succession was titled, "Exports Help Drive Up Fuel Prices." And the gist of this article concluded that America and the prices that we're experiencing in America for oil and natural gas, those were going up in part or largely because domestic energy producers are exporting oil and liquefied natural gas to other countries and other regions of the world. But, right, as we discussed in a prior Far Middle podcast, our crude oil and refined gasoline import and export balance, it's complicated, and it relates to refining capacity and the refiners and refineries' designs and how that correlates to the crude oil quality for the United States producers as well as for foreign players. And for LNG exports of natural gas, a big driver of that currently is to improve the EU's geopolitical position with that little thing or that little tiff that's going on with Russia over what's going on in Ukraine. So then you take this issue of the paper, you go through that article, you take two flips of the pages in the section that I'm in, and it yields the following article, "Russia Slashes Gas Flows to Hurt Europe." So this article discussed how Putin is cutting back natural gas supplies to the EU to build leverage against the West, and I'm assuming ultimately to prevail in the Ukraine. Obviously, he's using energy as a geopolitical force multiplier. And again, we've talked about that issue and how energy security is national security and geopolitical force multipliers many times in prior Far Middle episodes. Now, what you didn't see in this edition of this newspaper, right, after reviewing those two articles, you didn't see another article about how the current administration continues to attack from the administrative state the domestic energy industry, and how the current administration is going to Saudi to beg for oil, and how it's dragging its feet on sending arms to the Ukraine to not anger Russia, and how it's going to Venezuela to ask for oil. But what it's not doing, right, is anything to help domestic energy here unleash more supply. So the paper could have titled such an article if it wrote it or published it two ways, borrowing heavily from the prior two titles I just gave you. I mean, one title would be, "Biden Administration Regulatory Attack Helps Drive Up Fuel Prices," or another potential title could be, "Biden Administration Regulatory Attack Slashes Domestic Energy Exports to Hurt Europe." Strange days, I think, when even down-the-middle business-oriented news organizations and the supposedly best and brightest in journalism engage in this type of coverage. So now you've got governments and their policies all over the globe that have helped manufacture crises in inflation and energy and recession risk and geopolitics. Well, guess what's happening to all those Code Red for Humanity climate change Armageddon commitments for nations when it comes to cutting CO2 and making hard commitments to do so under things like the Paris Accord and the Glasgow meetings? Well, in a word, nothing. The UN agreement to accelerate emission cuts at Glasgow 8 months ago has stalled. Inflation in Russia brought some harsh real-world reality to the dreamers and the talkers and the eco-warriors. And now nations are investing more into things like natural gas and oil and coal, except for the United States, of course, which continues to be led by the inept when it comes to policy, to the point where you almost want to drug test or provide some other sort of competency test to our leaders. A recent UN climate confab that was held in Bonn, Germany, It turned out to be a dud. And it looks like there's not going to be hard targets for CO2 emission cuts consistent with the Paris Accord until at best later this year, maybe even later than that. And I doubt that's going to happen unless things related to inflation and recession and energy scarcity and the Ukraine reverse for the better and reverse for the better quickly. EU bureaucrat put it best. I read this the other day. This bureaucrat said, "We have to acknowledge the broader geopolitical context and the challenges many face this year." Your reality, I guess, is a you know what. And that brings us to the next topic, because, by the way, it's been 17 months since the current administration took office. Time flies. Now, they brought with them a leftist version of energy policy, and they touted it as the Green Agenda. We were told it was going to be awesome in every way imaginable. So let's take a quick tally of how things have progressed over those past 17 months of this administration and its environmentalism slash energy policies that have placed upon the economy. So CO2 emissions are up, and that's weird because we were all told they would drop precipitously. Renewables, you know, those solar panels and those wind turbines from China that sometimes work, the growth of them, it slowed to a grind because of inflation, because of regulation and lawsuits, because of supply chain failures. Energy prices, you know, how are they doing now that wind and solar are increasingly competitive? At least we're told that. Well, energy prices are higher. They're way, way higher, to the point where coal companies are making more money than solar companies, particularly when you pull out the tax subsidy for the solar company. So this administration and its green agenda, it did the impossible. It made the coal industry highly profitable again. And geopolitically, did we see those nations with that oil curse or the energy curse, did we see them collapse? So let's take a look. Russia, fully funding its war of aggression on the back of higher energy prices. Saudi Arabia, its balance sheet has never looked better. You know, 17 months in, and the scoreboard looks a little ugly for the green agenda, the energy transition, and the leftist environmental movement. So welcome to the left's green nirvana. And that brings up another thought to connect, because, by the way, the good old Federal Reserve continues to be way, way behind the inflation curve. So the Federal Reserve can beat the drum all it likes with its recent 0.75% rate hike and talk about doing whatever is necessary to tame inflation. But as we discussed in prior episodes, what matters is not the absolute Fed fund rate, but instead the real Fed fund rate. So real Fed fund rate being defined is the difference, right, between the effective Fed fund rate minus the CPI or the inflation rate. If that real Fed fund rate is negative, what's it mean? It means inflation is not being tamed, and instead inflation is destroying household savings and value in the form of savings. So inflation ends up eating more of your savings than what the bank or market is providing you in interest or return. Currently, after the 0.75% rate hike in mid-June, the real Fed fund rate is around -7%, which remains roughly where it was prior to the 0.75 rate hike. And that -7%-ish, it's the worst and most negative since 1960. So only one of two things fixes this and gets the real Fed fund rate to zero. Inflation gets tamed or dissipates, or rates go much, much higher. So keep going, Fed, and you might want to make that post haste. And let's connect to another point regarding the Federal Reserve, because the Fed and its army of thousands of economists, they miss the most important and the most basic thing that it and they are supposed to track, which is inflation. Stable prices, that is the core focus and mission of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the ECB, and the Bank of Japan. Central banks all over the planet. Inflation prediction and understanding what causes it, it's Econ 101 stuff that's taught in high schools, but our army of Ivy League PhD economists, they missed it. And they missed it by a country mile. They weren't even close. They were off by 100%+. So again, remember the perspective of the mess that we're in now. This is the highest inflation levels we've seen in 40 years, and the experts in academia and at the Fed, they completely, totally missed it. So despite all this, or with all this in mind, are they licking their wounds and assessing what went wrong? Are they putting a pause on mission creep to get back to the basics and get the basics right first? Nope. Very little analysis on what went wrong and why. But I did see this. The ECB said that the accuracy of its inflation forecasts, quote, declined significantly during the COVID-19 crisis, end quote. So I'm not sure if that is an objective explanation or maybe just an excuse, sort of blaming the ineptitude on COVID. Can't really tell. But we've got even more to worry about, that the inability of central banks and the Federal Reserve and the government to get the basics right on things like inflation. Because prior Fed chair and now Treasury Secretary and free money advocate, Dr. Janet Yellen, she's lecturing us that these high energy prices and inflation, they should serve as motivation to run to renewable energy and the vaunted green transition even quicker and deeper. So she's advocating for what a normal person would do the opposite of. Just when the government has imposed energy policies that created energy scarcity that drove up prices, we need more of these policy prescriptions to create even more energy scarcity. So that's going to improve supply and demand when it comes to energy. And the government and the bureaucrats, they are competent to assign the cure for supply and demand issues in energy and everything else when it comes to these things by getting into energy policy matters because, you know, Treasury did such a great job with something fully in its responsibility, which was with inflation. Maybe we should stop listening to these people and entities that created this mess, or maybe we listen to them, but then we take the exact opposite approach. Yeah, for sure. The Fed saying it's aggressively fighting inflation with higher rates is one thing, quite different than what it's actually doing, which is furthering the level and period of time for negative real interest rates. And the Fed pretending it can see around the future corners is different than the reality of running blind full force into an inflation wall. The fiction versus the fact theme, it really leads us to our next topic. And this is something I came across recently that I had, you know, little interest in at first glance. But once again, I got sucked into this issue and it turned out to be totally intriguing. It all started when a colleague of mine gave me a technical paper talking about something I would never be drawn to on its face. What's going on with the flow of the Ganges River in India? But my colleague handed me this technical paper and he said with a tempting hook, "You're going to love this, read it, and you're welcome." Well, I had to read it after that, and I'm very happy that I did. And I really wanted to share, you know, some of the insights that this study sort of presented with respect to, of all things, the flow of the Ganges River. So there's two researchers out there, IR and Raina. They published a paper on how the media and academia, bureaucrats, environmentalists, they're creating false alarms about the retreat of Himalayan glaciers. And the media and the environmentalist storyline that's been pushed incessantly is that the glaciers in the Himalayas are receding and melting from climate change, and that this is going to make key rivers like the Indus River and the Ganges run dry in the future. So, for example, The Economist in 2019 said that, quote, about 70% of the Ganges flow is contributed by meltwater from the Himalaya glaciers, end quote. And there are authors out there. There's an author, Victor Mallet, who wrote in his book, River of Life, River of Death, basically the same thing that The Economist reported. Now, this stuff matters for a lot of reasons, because what your view is on the future flow of key rivers like the Ganges and very populated areas of the world, it will set geopolitical tensions, because you got Pakistan and India and China. They're all squaring off in that neighborhood, and water resources can be a flashpoint. It says it sets agriculture policy in that region. So billions of people live there once again. So agriculture policy, which feeds those billions, matters. If you think water is going to be scarcer from these key rivers, you switch to other forms of agriculture potentially with different crops, which can amp up risk unnecessarily. So despite all this stuff mattering tremendously, you know, the positions, the views, the projections, they're based on flaws or flawed assumptions. They're based on mistruths, and in some instances, they're frankly based on lies. So first, consider the glaciers. You know, they've been melting across this planet for almost 12,000 years now, or in other words, since the end of the last ice age. That's what happens when you exit ice ages. It's totally normal. Second, extensive research has shown that the rate of glacier retreat for the primary glacier that feeds the Ganges River has been decelerating in recent decades, not accelerating, to where the current rate that the glacier is moving at or receding at, it will last 3,000 years, which seems to me to be a pretty long time. And that's despite rising temperatures, so go figure. Third, in the dry season, the Ganges does not get most of its flow from glacier melt. Instead, the vast majority of the Ganges flow comes from snow melt in the dry season, not glacier melt. Glacier melt contributes less than 1% of the Ganges flow and about 2% of the Indus River's flow. So snowmelt contribution much higher to both rivers, and as you move downstream, the glacier melt becomes a minuscule portion of the total flow. Now in 2007, that stellar entity, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said in a report that, quote, glaciers in the Himalayas are receding faster than in any other part of the world, and if the present rate continues, the likelihood of them disappearing by the year 2035, and perhaps sooner, is very high, end quote. Now, thanks to the good work by those researchers, IR and Reyna, we can be confident that yet again, the IPCC and its doomsday proclamations and predictions, it's totally wrong, and the science behind it was totally false. And by the way, the IPCC retracted its fake science statement in that report that I just read to you. So let's continue to press and insist that environmental policy should be based on truth and science, not be fabricated off of fears or some populist view. Again, I love that stuff. I had to share it with the constant listeners. This is the only podcast that you can find where you will be linking in a single episode Roger Maris's 61 home runs in 1961 to what the contributing sources are of the flow of the Ganges River in the dry season and how sort of glaciers and climate change tie into that. So something to always look forward to with the far middle. So don't worry about your beachfront property, if you're lucky enough to own any, disappearing underwater anytime soon. Particularly, this leads me to the next topic of real estate in Malibu, California. Now, you know we like tracking real estate and the real estate bubble on the far middle. If there's any doubt about how the 0.1% benefited the most from things like Federal Reserve easy money policy and government policy and environmentalism creating scarcity and asset bubbles, look no further than what's going on in that elitist little enclave of Malibu, California. So a compound recently, let me just give you a little Malibu, California real estate update, a compound on the water, 5 acres, and who knows how many buildings are located on this compound. I saw the aerial photo. There's many buildings on this single sort of property unit. It listed recently for $225 million, which would be a record for the state of California, with the most outrageous asset bubbles in the land. So that's a record in the most bubbly of bubble markets when it comes to real estate. The average, this is an amazing statistic, the average median price for a single family home in Malibu in the first quarter of 2022. What do you think it is? The average median sales price, $6.99 million. Why not just make it a cool $7 million? Wonder how we got to 6.99. Think about having a $7 million mortgage. And this is the median. You know, this isn't the highest. This is the median. Last year, over 80 properties in Malibu sold for over $5 million each. And if you want to know where one of the loudest pops is going to come from when the real estate bubble bursts, turn an ear towards Malibu. Wait, what's that sound? Did I just hear something? Because this might be the start of that popping as we speak. So cover your ears, because to borrow the title of a rock guitar documentary featuring the guitarist from one of my favorite bands, The Edge of U2, who is a Malibu guy, by the way, he owns Malibu property, it might get loud. Okay, to use a horse racing line, down the stretch we come for episode 61. I want to conclude by linking Malibu to where we started. So Roger Maris, born in Hibbing, Minnesota. Now guess who else grew up there? A guy named Robert Zimmerman, who became better known by his stage name of Bob Dylan, who lives in Malibu. Now, don't know if Dylan fans realize this, but there is a Bob Dylan Center that houses his archives, over 100,000 of his documents, and it's not in Hibbing, Minnesota, and it's not in Duluth, Minnesota, where he was born, or Malibu, where he lives, or New York City in Greenwich Village, where the Beat Generation and folk singers and Dylan has so much of its and his history. It's in, of all places, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And why is it in Tulsa, Oklahoma? Well, you got to thank George Kaiser and his foundation. I had the chance to meet Mr. Kaiser. He is an awesome individual. He's a banker. He's an energy industry expert. He's a family man. He's down to earth. He's a billionaire. He's respected. And he is, in the end, a humanitarian who commits vast sums of his wealth to better his hometown of Tulsa and beyond. So he was born and raised in Tulsa. He still lives there. I love that about the guy. And I spent a few hours with him a few years back, and he is one of those individuals and who just comes across as a normal person in demeanor, But when you spend a few minutes with him, it becomes apparent very quickly, after about 10 minutes, this individual's brilliant behind his easygoing attitude. So his aura shines very, very bright. He works 70 hours a week. Told me he splits his time between his business interests and his philanthropy efforts. So check out the George Kaiser Foundation online when you're done listening. I think you'll be inspired. So Mr. Kaiser does what he does, right? Back to the Bob Dylan Center. He creates things and makes things happen that no one would ever think of, and no one would ever be able to pull off or have the audacity to think that they could. So when news broke in 2016 that Dylan had given his vast archive of recordings and artifacts to the George Kaiser Family Foundation in Tulsa, you know, people were taken aback. Why was this sort of treasure trove of musical genius and this cultural treasure trove, why was it going to Tulsa of all places? And that sort of archive of Dylan memorabilia, it's become basically the cornerstone of the museum and the Bob Dylan Center. And the way Bob Dylan himself explained it, he said, quote, "There's more vibrations on the coast for sure, but I'm from Minnesota and I like the casual hum of the heartland," end quote. Hey, me too, Bob, me too. Okay, everybody, get out there and do, constant listeners. We will chat again in a week.